guess at this point in time, there is nobody that is not fully aware of the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. It is a story not too unlike EAA, where with determination, with character, with discipline, and with patience, things can happen. They don't happen overnight, but they do happen when you have all of those traits. They are the men of the Tuskegee Airmen Group. During World War II, bomber pilots and crews were the targets of fierce enemy defenses. Yet many of those crews say they never felt safer than when the red-tailed Mustangs of the Tuskegee Airmen joined them to fly cover. The legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen continues today as they pass on their heritage and their dedication to duty and their extremely high standards to a new generation. Tonight, we are privileged to hear firsthand from several of the original Tuskegee Airmen. Hosting tonight's discussion panel is Bev Dungel, president of the Chicago chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen. And before I bring them out, I'd like to remind you that fighting against the enemy on one front and fighting yet another front that was racism. They were combating those two areas, fascism and racism, and yet they stood tall and they excelled to the point of being exemplary then and today. We appreciate them so much. Let me bring them out in just a second. But if you know the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, before I bring them out, you will join me in standing. And could we turn on the house lights so when our guests come out, they will see the audience as well? Crew, can we do that? Thank you. I'd like to first introduce you to Major Welton Taylor. Thank you. Remain standing as I introduce you to First Lieutenant Bev Dungel. Gentlemen, thank you for being here tonight. I know you're having a great time. You've got your vest mics working. I want first for either one of you to start with the point in time at which some of the discussions we had in back. There it is. That's better. The point in time for you when it started, and then just bring us up to this point. And as you're doing that, you can add any of the situations or the areas where you were and how things were going, and add all the detail that you possibly want. And I'll let you flip a coin as to who's going to start. And by the way, I don't have the coin either. Okay, I think you just volunteered, Bill. Somebody pointed to you. He's off on your left. It wasn't me.
Well. Actually, from the time that I was 3 years old, I wanted to fly. That's as far back as I can remember. So I've always wanted to fly, and I was able to accomplish that goal in my life. And I was trained by a fellow by the name of Coffey, Cornelius R. Coffey. I don't know if maybe some of you pioneers in aviation remember Coffey. He was an aviation man, had a flying school, and he happened to be black. and he saw in me a kid that wanted to fly so bad he could taste it. I was 16 at the time, and he created a job in his flying school for me, and I was still in high school. I started flying at 16. And if I could have, I think I would have paid him to work for him because I wanted to fly so bad. And that's my start in aviation.
From that start, take us back to the year, if you would, and the location where all that took place.
That was in 1943. I've only been flying for 66 years. And that was at Harlem Airport, which is a suburb of Chicago. Those of you who are aware of, know about Chicago, it's from 87th to 95th, from Harlem to Ridgeland. And that was Harlem Airport. Sodden runways, hangars, J-3 aircraft. Now, I started out flying a J-2 aircraft, which was a 40-horsepower engine. Hmm. It's just a little more powerful than your lawnmower. And I went in next into a 65-horse engine, Piper Cub J-3. From that into the J-4. And then I went into the service. I was 18 years and 2 months when I went into the service. That was when I started flying the Stearman and the military. And from there on into other aircraft, graduated PT-13, AT-6, P-40, and then subsequently the P-51, and then the F-80s, which is a jet, and the F-86, which is fighter, and the F-86D fighter, which was an all-weather fighter interceptor, as well as flying test in the Air Force. So I think that's about what covers it.
Okay. So what I think we just found out here, a transition from the Second World War right into the jet age, and that meant Korea?
Yes.
Okay, great. Of those aircraft, I've asked Bob Hoover this question over the years. You named quite a number of aircraft, most of them in the combat role. Of those combat aircraft that you flew, what would be your favorite, one that sparks the most memories for you as being the most, fulfilling?
Well, having flown both the 51 and the 86, there are different types of aircraft, and basically they end up being what I, as a jet fighter pilot, would consider a lower aircraft, lower altitude aircraft as a P-51. And then the 86 is a higher altitude aircraft with more speed than the speed, and the 86, I think, can outfly the 51, not as far as turning inside or maneuverability is concerned, but because you can take an 86, do an element, lose the P-51, come back and get on the tail at any point, and do it much easier and much better. So I would say overall, the F-86.
This is amazing because of all the aircraft that Bob Hoover has tested, in a quiet evening at dinner with a bunch of air show pilots and Mr. Hoover, we asked him that question, and without hesitation, he said the best airplane I ever flew was the F-86. So these two great men have something in common. Let's see. Now, let's go on to Bev. You seem kind of shy over there. Let's do the same thing. Bring us up through. Bring us up through the same format, where it started.
I started making model airplanes probably when I was 3 or 4. And
in 1912.
He's the youngest of the regular documented original Tuskegee Airmen in the country. Shall I tell him your age?
Go ahead. I'm the baby of the group.
No. He's 82. If anybody tells you he's a documented Tuskegee Airman and he's less than 82, he's lying, not lying. Now, by the time I was 6 years old, I had turned professional. I was making models and selling them in my grade school to get more money to build more models to sell in my grade school. It was a vicious cycle. I flew them, and once I flew them, I wasn't interested anymore. I wanted bigger and better. Now, I never became a speed freak like him. I always figured that 65 horsepower was as much as you needed to win a war. Now, see, you don't know that the Tuskegee Airmen were not only fighter pilots and flew in two wars like both of us did. Incidentally, we both ended up majors and we both started out as first lieutenants, so there's no difference on that. And I'm very proud of being a first lieutenant. I stayed one for 11 years. I couldn't get promoted. The situation was that he turned me down. I was graduating from college with Charles McGee, and I were both in high school together and both in college together. He was always a freshman, I was always a senior. But when I graduated as senior, he quit in his sophomore year and he enlisted. And he got into the Tuskegee Airmen. And they called me down there my senior year to test me so I could come into the Air Corps too. Oh, you can never fly for Uncle Sam because you don't have 20/20 vision uncorrected. Well, I couldn't help that. I've been wearing cheaters since I was 14. I needed them before then. So when they offered me the chance to be the adjutant of the 99th Pursuit Squadron, I weighed the things. I'm going to sit around and count the paper clips, sharpen pencils, and misfile personnel data. And I'm going to get promoted every 6 months, lieutenant, first lieutenant, and then on right on up. If B.O. Davis goes up to general, I go up to full colonel. Never have to leave Tuskegee, never have to do anything but watch these fuzzy-faced kids go through and become fighter pilots and go overseas while I'm counting paper clips. I don't have the guts for that. I told them, look, I'm going to be a field artillery officer and I'm going to be a good one, but I'm going to do everything in the field artillery that a two-star general can do. So thank you, but no thanks. So I went on into the field artillery and found out I was the first black field artilleryman in history because all of the black colleges had nothing but infantry. So I established a precedent there. Then along came a combat unit that wanted me to leave the training school, and I did. And ended up in Fort Custer, Michigan, where I was 200 miles from Chicago and 200 miles from Detroit. Well, where was I? We were separated from the mother unit and split in two parts, and I ended up in Tennessee, Camp Forest, Tennessee, and that was a wonderful place. I had my first two race riots there, which is something the Air Corps never had. And don't forget, I was field artilleryman. And so we had our race riots there, so they sent us to Georgia to cool off. And the first weekend we were in Augusta, Georgia, we had our third race riot. So I figured I'd been cooled off enough, and so my commanding officer says, I've tried to get you your captaincy three times and failed for the same reason. It always came. Promotions to the rank of captain above not favorably received this headquarters, 2nd Army, Atlanta, Georgia, for colored officers. So they put an asterisk behind my name, and every time you read my name on any sheet, the asterisk came down to the bottom. These are colored personnel. So that prevented my getting promotions. So my colonel says, look, you've got a pilot's license, which I had gotten when I was turned down. I went out and got a private pilot's license before Pearl Harbor. So when they said, I'm going to put you in for liaison training, because you could fly liaison planes with glasses. Of course, it said in your record, this pilot is not to fly anything unless he is wearing corrective lenses. Well, I flew a lot of things with corrective lenses. I flew B-24s, I flew C-47s, and I flew executive aircraft, but I never put them in my logbook because I would have gotten court-martialed. No, you can do things, but you can't always tell people about it. Now I'm safe. So, so I ended up going to overseas with the 93rd Division, which was the first black division to go overseas. And we received desert warfare training up the Kazoo in the Mojave Desert. So they sent us to Guadalcanal. The enemy was not confused. We got to Guadalcanal, and the first day we were there, the first night I should say, Tokyo Rose welcomed us by name. I didn't know where we were going until they told us the next morning, you're going to climb down the ropes on the ship. We're putting you ashore on Guadalcanal at 0900. That's when I found out when I was going there. She knew, but I didn't mind that. She played the best Duke Ellington records and Count Basie records we heard the whole time we're overseas. So then the problem comes, now we're going to be in combat. That's what I'm waiting for. While we were on the ship that night, there was a terrible storm on the horizon, and a ship's officer came up, and I said, that's a terrible storm over there, the booms and the flashes of lightning and the thunder and the blackness out there from the ship's rail. He says, what time is it? I said, it's 11:45. He says, at midnight, we're going to call you into the dining room. We're going to tell you that we're putting, that's Guadalcanal, and that's not a storm. That's the Japanese fleet shelling hell out of it. He says, and we're going to call you in and tell you at 9 o'clock tomorrow, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, we're putting you ashore on Guadalcanal. They sure know how to ruin a man's sleep, don't they? I spent all night sharpening the two Bowie knives that I had in addition to my .45 and the stuff that the government gave me. I wanted the hometown stuff to be with me. So when the boat comes to the shore and they drop the ramp, I run out of there with my .45 in one hand and my Bowie knife in the other, and there are four little ladies coming down the beach, white outfits and Red Cross armbands. Now, you boys want coffee? You want tea? I took coffee and two sugar cookies. And I said, they said war was hell, but they never said it was this surprising. So what happened is, now I'm in combat. I'm on Guadalcanal. We get on Guadalcanal the day after Guadalcanal is considered to be safe. When the Navy and the Marines consider to be safe doesn't mean that you're by yourself out there. There are hot and cold running enemy soldiers all over the place. So what you have to do is you have to push them back enough so you get a little area of yourself where you feel it relatively safe to sleep at night. What about my planes? Well, I don't have any planes. Nothing is more desolate than a planeless pilot. Especially since you go 90 days without flying, you lose flight pay. That's 50% of base pay. That ain't hay. So we found our planes finally and got in the air and found that we're flying off of a strip with the Texas bunch called the Cactus Air Force, the 13th Air Force. Came out of Kelly Field, Texas, where you had an airplane park, three rattlesnakes, an airplane park, three rattlesnakes, an airplane. You could get killed trying to get your plane. And they were the P-38 pilots on the same field with me. And so after we got to know each other a little better, and I was using their dark room at night for free film for my camera, we moved out to Bougainville. Now, at Bougainville, there was real fighting. The Japanese were terribly strong there, over 100,000 of them. We moved in with the Mercal Division and chewed up enough of the island so we had a foothold. And then my unit was sent over next door to it at Mono Island so our big guns could cover the slot and not let any more Japanese ships through. And we did it very well. But then I caught ground duty, things that Air Force doesn't do, field artillerymen do. They call, the infantry calls for field artillery observer, and you go out there, and usually your commanding officer sends a guy who wants to get killed because he's going out with the infantry. So you never know whether it's an honor or an attempt at failure to survive. And that's the kind of war we fought. Now, in the air, all I did was fly around, drop supplies to the infantry forces that were making inroads into Japanese territory, and flying across the island, carrying supplies over to a missionary that had been on Guadalcanal 13 years. Then when we left Guadalcanal and Bougainville, we moved to the big island, New Guinea. And on New Guinea, again, we didn't have my unit because I was always with the generals, and the generals are, just generally speaking, are not intimately involved in the war. The generals do things on maps and says, we're going to give this section to this company and this section to this company and make it so. And then the colonels say to the majors and captains, this is the section we're going to have and we're supposed to do this, make it so. And then it comes down to the lieutenant, he says to the sergeant, take a platoon out there and take that hill, take another platoon out there and take that hill, and make it so. The war is fought by sergeants. Okay? Those know, they know, they know. The wars are fought and won by sergeants. And the better sergeants you have, the quicker the war goes. Now, I have 65 horsepower, but I have 48 guns behind me. All I have to do is find out where the enemy is and call for artillery fire on them, and then let the infantry walk in and occupy the territory. Now, those real estate agents are the difference between winning and losing, because there's an old saying in wartime, you ain't won nothing until you occupy the territory. So the field artillery is the beloved of the infantryman because we make it possible for him to go. Now, where my guns end, at about 12 miles, we end up calling on him. Yeah. Anything over 12 miles you can have. But I will stake out that first 12 miles and I'll win the war 12 miles at a time if you don't do your part. But the important thing is, we, as Tuskegee Airmen, had the fighter pilots doing their thing to see that the bombers did their thing and got back safely. We had the 477th bomber group for the 70% of the pilots that they wouldn't allow to be fighter pilots, because the Air Force says if everybody's a fighter pilot, who's going to fly the bombers? So we've got a quota system, 30% fighter pilots, 70% bomber pilots. Well, what am I, chopped liver? What about the liaison pilots? So, well, they're not Air Force. They're ground force. They're field artillery. So nobody ever says that there were 58 liaison pilots trained by the Tuskegee Airmen at Tuskegee, because we weren't Air Corps. But nobody ever says that half of them went to the South Pacific with me. So I did my job in the South Pacific just like they did their job in Europe. And we had just as much no publicity as they had publicity. But I want you to know that the Tuskegee Airmen protected your rights no matter which ocean was our barrier, and no matter which brand of enemy we fought. And the only reason we won our part of the war later than they did is the Japanese didn't surrender 250,000 troops at a time. They took the atom bomb.
Tell us more. I saw you here cringing in your hands. Well, I'm going to get my turn. Any comments based on what you just heard?
Several hundred.
Would you care to share them with us? Remembering their families out here, their young children.
Well, my experiences primarily were, my combat experience, I should say, was primarily in Korea. As Welton mentioned, I'm the baby of the group. You see, I'm only 82 years old, 82. And I'm the baby of the group, the youngest of the original Tuskegee Airmen. World War II ended when I was in flight training. So I did not get a chance to fly combat, as did fellows like you mentioned, Charlie McGee, fellows in the Chicago Dodo chapter like Bob Williams,
Bob Martin,
George Taylor, and Shelby Westbrook, and various other guys. But basically, my combat experience was in jets in Korea. So I can't address any problems or questions that they had other than general knowledge, which I may have learned in the manner that you have learned of combat in Europe. But my primary experience has been in Korea in jets and the F-86. I flew 100 combat missions in Korea. And thank you.
My camera's left on the camera's back the stage. I've got to go back in the stage.
And I really, to some extent, I enjoyed flying combat because at that point, you lived or died by your own skill. And that was primarily the function of being able to see the enemy, that is the MiGs, and they tried as much as possible to come out of the sun. And my glasses are tinted because I have looked into the sun quite a bit. And having sunglasses and a visor with sunshades, and still you look into the sun and you can see at altitude, you can see the sun here and a wing sticking out from the sun. You know a plane is trying to shoot at you, will be shooting very shortly, and your best bet is then to turn into him as much as possible, as sharp as possible, because that he's not going to be able to change his attitude in order to shoot you down. And the sooner you do that, the better. Obviously, because it's kind of miserable getting shot down. That kind of ruins your day. So, again, you're able to control a lot of the action of the enemy because of the action that you take to avoid getting shot down. And so this is the cooperate, the coordination, if you will, between your mind and your action and body in order to stay alive, which of course is the main purpose of being there, to not get shot down, because getting shot down really kind of spoils your day a little bit.
You've come up with some of the things I was going to address earlier, and I thank you for doing that. Your opinion first of the enemy's airplane, which would have been the MiG-15.
Yes.
First, give me your opinion of that versus the F-86 from the way you saw it.
Okay, the F-86 and the MiG-15 are two aircraft which are almost identical in performance. And you've got to know the advantage and disadvantage of your airplane and the advantage and disadvantage of the MiG. For example, the MiG is a slightly lighter, weight-wise, a slightly lighter aircraft with as powerful or equally powerful engine as does the F-86. As a result, being slightly lighter overall weight and the equal power, he can raise his nose about 5 degrees and literally walk away from you. On the other hand, you can lower your nose about 5 degrees or 10 degrees and walk away from him. Bad idea, but it's still, you can do it. Because when you get in a situation like that, thing to do is roll over and get away that way. Because your rate of roll is so much faster than the MiG's that you could literally make a three-quarter roll and come out this way, and he's just about in that position, roughly about 30% less than in roll power than you. Your rate of roll is extremely fast. For example, if you take the stick and go from the center point all the way over to the right, as fast as you, well, not as fast, but just going from center point over to the right stop. And within the time to go from here to there, which is get over to the stop, you've gone around 3.5 times. Now that's a nice rate of roll. And you can get away from somebody. Whichever way you roll left or right, you can make a three-quarter roll from here around to there and eliminate the fact that he's going to follow you, and he's just about in this position when you're over here going this way. So the only thing he can do is go that way. When that happens, you've lost him, because by the time he gets to the point of making a 360-degree circle, you're gone, or vice versa. It doesn't take very much time to get away from somebody when you're going 10 miles a minute, and that's 600 knots per hour, 600 miles knots per hour. So these are the things that you have to know in order to be able to stay alive or to attack the enemy.